طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm and continued in his memory by a group of his colleagues. This is John Roberts. The major news out of Palestine this week is the announcement that Fatah, which governs and controls the West Bank, and Hamas, which controls and governs Gaza, have reached an agreement to form a unity government, ending years of separation by the two parties. Most of the international community has welcomed and even cheered the move to a unity government. But of course, Israel, who vigorously criticized the Palestinians for their division, now excoriates the unity deal because it means accepting Hamas into the unity government, and Hamas, according to Netanyahu, is a terrorist organization. And Israel knows all about terrorist organizations and the role they play in establishing a people's independence. Israel was born out of the terrorist activities of the Haganah, the Irgun, and the Stern Gang. Ben-Gurion, Begin, and Shamir, now considered founding fathers of Israel, were terrorists in the eyes of the British under the Mandate. Your terrorist is my patriot. It is all in the eye of the beholder. But what does this mean for Palestinians? I spoke by phone with Samer Jaber, my former co-host on this program, in Bethlehem, and asked him for his initial reaction to this formation of the unity government. It is only days old, so it is difficult to make too many observations. But he was disappointed that the 8 new ministries that were created under the new government were assignments made based more on patronage than any democratic process that would have sent a signal about how the new government will be developing. As Samer said, this was more a business deal between the two parties than a democratic merger. Still, there is maneuvering for power going on, which hopefully will not blow up the deal in the near future. For instance, the Palestinian Authority, still under control of Fatah, transferred money to its people last Tuesday evening, but failed to transfer it into Gaza for the Hamas people. Such actions do not build trust. Also, Fatah arrests of Hamas operatives in the West Bank continues to build resentment. Old habits are hard to break, especially if it means giving up or sharing some power. The unity deal is fragile, very fragile. Supposedly there will be elections to democratically choose the leadership of the new unity government in 6 months. That has to happen if the unity deal is to garner any credibility in the international community. This deal would not have been struck if Abbas did not have the support of the international community and the United States. Of course, it remains to be seen if the United States will give overt support to the unity government going forward if Israel continues to trash the deal. Standing up to Israel is not something the United States does these days, especially with this Congress. Major questions. Will the political process in both the West Bank under Fatah control and Gaza under Hamas control be free and open? Will the elections be truly democratic? And will the political leaders of both parties trust the Palestinian people to choose the country's direction? Or will, as too often in the past, they ultimately will betray the people they claim to serve? We will continue to bring you reports from the ground as the process proceeds. International commentary is just beginning to flow, but I found this piece by the Australian journalist Cesar Shalala, written in response to Israel's negativity, to be interesting. Here is Shalala's take. The formation of a new unity government between Fatah and Hamas, although strongly resisted by the Israeli government leadership, may offer some hope for eventually leading to renewed peace talks between the Palestinian Authority and Israel's government. For Mr. Netanyahu to resist this union is a futile exercise that may contribute to Israel's international isolation. Netanyahu couldn't hide his displeasure at the agreement between Fatah and Hamas. Today, Abu Mazen, as Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is called, said yes to terrorism and no to peace, said Netanyahu. Israel's economy minister, Naftali Bennett, was even more aggressive, saying, "The government of terrorists in suits established by Fatah and Hamas, the very same organization that in its charter has horrific sentences such as calling for killing the Jews who are hiding behind trees and stones, is an illegitimate government." Although this statement is certainly indefensible, so are similar statements made by leading Israeli officials regarding the Palestinians. They are no reason in themselves to refuse to recognize the new Palestinian government or to maintain contact with it. Urging Israel to go from defense to offense, Bennett urged the annexation of settlement blocks in the West Bank. The actions proposed by Bennett have been strongly condemned by important Israeli figures. In the meantime, the number of settlements in the West Bank grew threefold and fourfold, and the brutality of the occupation increased to the point where soldiers now shoot demonstrators out of nothing but boredom, wrote Gideon Levy, a leading Israeli journalist. Although the U.S. government is clearly concerned about the role of Hamas in the new government, State Department spokeswoman Jean Psaki said last Monday that although the U.S. will work with a new government, it would also be watching closely to ensure that it upholds principles that President Abbas reiterated today. Abbas said that the 17-member cabinet would comprise essentially technical officials who would strive to pursue peace, despite Hamas's refusal to accept coexistence with Israel. He also acknowledged that previous divisions between the movements had derailed the Palestinians' aims. Netanyahu not only refused to recognize the new government, but appealed to the international community not to recognize it. At the same time, the Israeli government refused travel permissions to three Gaza-based ministers to travel to the West Bank for the swearing-in ceremony. There are still serious disagreements between the two Palestinian movements, such as how to join rival security forces in Gaza and the West Bank. However, President Abbas, before presiding over the cabinet's first meeting, stated, "This black page in our history has been turned forever, and we will never go back." Abbas has already made some important concessions to the Israeli government. It is pledged that the new administration will abide by the principles laid down by the Middle East Peace Quartet. It will recognize Israel's right to exist, and it will reject violence and abide by existing agreements. These conditions have been repeatedly rejected by Hamas in the past. These pledges are not enough for Netanyahu. who has continued the illegal and widely condemned blockade of Gaza, which has resulted in shortages of food and basic medicines that have hurt children's lives. With his characteristic double standard, Netanyahu said, "Enough of these tricks. If this new Palestinian government has regained sovereignty over Gaza, the first thing that Abbas should do is announce he is starting to demilitarize Gaza." It is not a view shared by all Israelis. Writing in Haaretz, Gideon Levy said, "The world cannot lend its hand to this. It is unacceptable in the 21st century for a state that purports to be a permanent member of the free world to keep another nation deprived of rights. It is unthinkable and simply unthinkable for millions of Palestinians to continue to live in these conditions. It is unthinkable for a democratic state to continue to oppress them in this way. It is unthinkable that the world stands by and allows this to happen." That was Caesar Chalala, who was a foreign correspondent for the Middle East Times International. This morning, the feature presentation is a speech delivered by Max Blumenthal at a forum he participated in featuring observations he made over a four-year period when he lived in Israel and conducted countless interviews throughout the Israeli society in preparation for his latest book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Most of us know Israel through the eyes of the mainstream media and spokespersons for the Israeli government. Blumenthal presents the society through the eyes of those who comprise much of Israeli society, whom he interviewed, and it is not a pretty picture. However, it is important that we in the United States see this picture, because it is of a society we support with literally billions of dollars of financial aid. Here is author and journalist Max Blumenthal.
Max Blumenthal is an award-winning journalist. He's a filmmaker, he's a blogger, and a speaker, as we'll soon find out. And he's the national best-selling author of his first book, released in 2009, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. Max's talk this morning will focus on themes from his recently published book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in the Greater Israel. This bold and controversial book is the product of 4 years of research on Israel-Palestine at a very transitional phase, beginning with the national elections carried out during Israel's war on Gaza in 2008 and 2009, which brought into power what he calls Israel's most right-wing government to date. Max tells the story of Israel-Palestine in the wake of the collapse of the Oslo peace process. It is, as I put it, it's not an easy read. My wife will testify that I took it in small doses, 3 or 4 chapters a night. I would call it a painful read, but it is a necessary read. I recommend it to everybody. Max's plenary this morning is titled Sundown Towns and the Anti-Miscegenation Crusades, the Peculiar Institutions of Israel. It is with very great pleasure that I introduce Max Blumenthal.
So much, Mark. And so, you know, I feel rich being here today and pledging my fealty to Naeem Atik and being with Craig and Cindy Corey and so many of my heroes, my intellectual and moral heroes. You know, what we're hearing from the people who bow down before Adelson, and on the Democratic side, they bow down before Haim Saban, and what we hear from Israel and Netanyahu, the language we hear from them, is that might makes right. And I think you know, what we're here today to affirm and what we believe in just a short sentence is that rights make might. I have had a hard time at some points promoting this book. The Zionist gag rule is applied to me, and you know, they found out that I had nothing to lose. There was no job they could take away from me. There was... But they still tried. They tried to pressure the donors at various think tanks I spoke at, the New America Foundation, to cancel my talk. In Dallas, the local AIPAC chapter tried to cancel a talk I did at the Dallas World Affairs Council. And, you know, we see acts of repression on campus after campus, attempts to the Northeastern Students for Justice in Palestine has been suspended for leafleting. I was just at the University of Michigan. There was just a massive campaign of suppression there. There are bills in several states to punish academic organizations for calling for a boycott. And it's clear that, first of all, they won't debate me or any of us on the facts. They won't discuss this issue on the merits. And there's something that the pro-Israel forces in this country are trying to cover up. There's something they're afraid of, and what it is simply the facts on the ground and history. And that's what I sought to do with this book, is just pack it all between two pages and show Americans the real Israel they don't know. And in order for me to be able to do that, I have to tell the story of 1947 and 1948. Because, as William Faulkner said about the American South, the past isn't even dead. The past is never past. It isn't even dead. And that is the case in Israel-Palestine today, this single unitary space between the river and the sea, where everyone exists under a regime of separation with different rights based on the circumstances of their birth. And that system was born in 1948, and I write about in the, I think it was in the Jezreel Valley, about an incident in which local kibbutz had been, a group of kibbutzim had feared for their safety, and there was an Arab man who was accused of sexually attacking some of the women from the kibbutz. And so Yitzhak Sadeh, and any of you who know the history of Israel will know this name, he founded the Palmach, which is the elite strike force of the Haganah, which is celebrated widely today in Israel, gave classes at a local hospital on castration. And he instructed two of his students, Yochai bin Nun, who went on to found the Israeli Navy, and Amos Horev, who became the president of the Technion and was an original member of the Turkel Commission of Inquiry into the Gaza Flotilla Raid. He instructed them on how to castrate Arabs. And so they captured a man, this man who was accused of sexually attacking women on the kibbutz. And according to the Israeli historian Gamliel Cohen, they dealt with him in accordance with the biblical principle that calls for the chopping off of a thief's hand, and which in this case would call for attacking the organ he used to perform the crime, namely for castrating him. And this was actually more common at this time than we acknowledge, than historians are willing to acknowledge. The Palmach actually developed a song based on these activities, and they would chant, "We castrated you, Muhammad, we castrated you." And it was really it was partly due to the fear of the indigenous male's sexuality, which struck terror in the hearts of this settler colonial population. I mean, those of you who have read the Regeneration Through Violence, books like that, know that this was common in this country during its settler colonial phase. And in a purely strategic sense, castrations carried out by the Palmach under the guidance of medical professionals were designed as a deterrent against further sexual attacks, instilling terror in the Palestinian rural population while restoring the confidence of Jewish women living in adjacent kibbutzim. But they also contained a deeper significance that found its roots in fin de siècle European colonialism. Through its brazen castrations, the Palmach militia sought to symbolically neuter the Palestinian national movement, asserting Zionist dominance in a struggle between two patriarchal societies where virility and victory were intertwined. And that struggle continues with one side, of course, dominant over the other, yet still terrified and yet still engaged in a process of settler colonialism, where the power has been transferred into the hands of a religious nationalist movement. And I'm going to talk about that and bring this up to date. And we'll see that 1948 for Palestinians, the Nakba, the catastrophe, is a daily occurrence. As Ilan Pappe said recently, there hasn't been a day in the state of Israel's history without one instance of ethnic cleansing or another. I came to understand this when I first started my work on this book, and I was living in Jaffa, which is the ghetto of Tel Aviv, the Palestinian ghetto where the remnants of ethnic cleansing of 1947 and 48 live. I lived on Dr. Ehrlich Street, which was named Fuad Dajani Street before 1948. Fuad Dajani ran the hospital across the street from me. It was seized by the State of Israel. Its staff was expelled, and it is now the Jacob Zahalon Geriatric Center. It's a it's a ward for mentally ill older people. Jacob Zahalon is a 17th century Italian physician who's as familiar to Jaffa as an ice skating rink. And Dr. Paul Ehrlich was a 19th century Austrian physician who had never set foot in Palestine. And right around the corner from me was Yitzhak Sadeh Street, named for the Palmach founder, who gave instructions on castrations. And the 1948 continued. Every day, right in front of my eyes, I noticed 500 standing eviction orders in Jaffa, all applying to Palestinian citizens of Israel. There was a clear plan, what the Israeli government calls Judaization. Jews in, Palestinians out. A new gated community called Andromeda Hills, reflecting the aggressive and politicized wave of gentrification in Jaffa, was filing noise complaints against the local church, St. George's Church, and the two mosques to silence the call of the muezzin and the tolling of the church bells. All of these structures predated the foundation of the State of Israel. Netanyahu endorsed this measure, which was soon introduced in the Knesset, declaring, "We don't need to be more liberal than Europe," linking himself in a political sense to the neo-fascists and xenophobes rising in Europe against a tide of immigrants. I noticed, not only in Jaffa, where settlers from the West Bank would march down the street chanting Jaffa for Jews, and where they firebombed my favorite fish restaurant owned by Palestinian Christians, where they vandalized the local Muslim cemetery, where they declared that there is no safe space anywhere, even in core Israeli cities, for democracy or for minority rights or equal protection for people who didn't embrace this bellicose vision of religious domination. I noticed it 15 minutes east in the Abu Ayyid refugee camp in Lod, which cannot declare itself as an official refugee camp and cannot receive aid from international agencies, but which consists of 15 families, hundreds of people whose homes were destroyed simply because they couldn't get building permits, because it's nearly impossible as a Palestinian citizen of Israel to get a permit to build according to your natural growth. Why? For the same reason that I described why Israel was seeking to drive out Palestinians in 1948. In order to maintain a Jewish state, you need to have a supermajority of Jews, a demographic majority, and you have to socially engineer through violence or through anti-democratic laws the level of Palestinians or indigenous people or non-Jews that live under your control. And so I arrived at this camp, and it was in rubble. It had been a neighborhood the day before, and I met children doing their homework in tents. During the rainy season, I met men standing over open fires. It looked like Gaza after Operation Cast Lead. It looked like Aleppo right now in Syria. And what people told me was that we wish we were in Gaza, because at least if we were in Gaza, we would get media coverage and the UN would supply us with aid. We get no UN protection against our government because we're non-Jewish citizens of Israel. The days of 48 have come again. I heard this again and again and again. And this is something that the right wing in Israel understands. Avigdor Lieberman recently said that nothing has changed since the days of the Tower and Stockade, referring to the early days of Zionism, the early days of settlement. That's why they're so popular, because like us, they understand 1948 as a continuous process. Unlike us, or I'll speak for myself, unlike me, who would like to see, who sees this as a crime that needs to be prosecuted and reversed, they see it as a project that needs to be continued to its completion. And so the mantra of the right wing, which is as long as the status quo continues, the right wing in Israel will hold a permanent majority. Their mantra is finish 48. And so we see finish 48 in the polls commissioned by the Israeli Democracy Institute, the premier polling firm in Israel, which show that a majority of Jewish Israeli youth under 18, year after year after year, declare their refusal to sit in a classroom with an Arab citizen of Israel. That a majority of Israelis declare their refusal to live next door to an Arab. That a plurality of Israelis in 2011 in the IDI poll declared their desire for detention camps for Palestinian citizens of Israel during wartime. And when is wartime in Israel? Well, it's been in a state of emergency since 1948 because, according to Eliakim Rubinstein, the Supreme Court Justice, Israel is a normal country that is not normal. We hear finish 48 in the words of Tzipi Hotoveli, who is the Deputy Transportation Minister, is younger than me, is the Sarah Palin of Israel and speaks better English than Sarah Palin. She's an attractive, telegenic woman who declared that I am a Jewish racist. Ani gezanut Yahudi. I want a Jewish majority. I want a Jewish state. And that pretty much sums up the mentality of the rulers, of the current rulers of Israel and the future leaders in a nutshell. It's why Hotoveli told Hanin Zoabi, the Palestinian Christian legislator and the most hated woman in Israel, that she would fight to ban her from the Knesset. And legislation has passed in the Knesset, raising the electoral threshold to make it nearly impossible for Palestinian parties to hold, like Balad, the party of Zoabi, to hold power. The day will come when the Knesset is Arab Rhine. We hear finish 48 in Naftali Bennett, the economic minister's plan to annex the West Bank, hand over Palestinians to Jordan, and force the rest in Area C to either take loyalty oaths to the Jewish state or be ethnically cleansed, and that is the plan. And we hear finish 48 in the tracts of state-funded rabbis, tracts like Torat HaMelech, the King's Torah, which I wrote about in my book and was harshly criticized for simply reporting on. The Israeli newspaper Ma'ariv calls it a guide for when it is permissible to kill non-Jews. And that is exactly what it is, produced by Yitzhak Shapira and Yitzhak Ginsburg, two state-funded Israeli rabbis based near Nablus from a settlement known for its price tag attacks on the local Palestinian population, which has also received thousands upon thousands of dollars from the tax-exempt nonprofit based on the Marcus Brothers textiles shop on Fifth Avenue in New York called the Central Fund for Israel. They produced this book, which is a guide for how and when it is permissible to kill non-Jews. Among the many lowlights of the book is that it is permissible to kill Gentile children if it is deemed that they will grow up to harm us. There are also two letters issued by hundreds, signed by hundreds of state-funded Israeli rabbis. Letters first declaring that it is illegal under Jewish law, of course this is a perversion of Jewish law, illegal under Jewish law to rent apartments to non-Jews, referring to Palestinians and African refugees. The second letter issued by rabbis' wives declared that it is illegal under Jewish law to have relationships between Jews and non-Jews, or what they refer to in the document as mixed marriages. And we know where that language has deep resonances in our society. And so these dual rabbinical letters inspired the anti-miscegenation movement in Israel, which sought to revive the spirit of Yitzhak Sadeh and the Palmach castration crews and finish 48 inside core Israeli cities through the organization Lahava, led by former followers of Meir Kahana, the assassinated terrorist rabbi who advocated an ethnically pure Jewish state from the river to the sea. Lahava set up a hotline allowing callers to inform on mixed marriages and interreligious and interracial relationships. They have placed leaflets around Jerusalem warning Arab men not to speak to Jewish women or face harsh punishment and violence. They've placed posters featuring Arab men, the dossiers and headshots of Arab men accused of making passes at Jewish women. They've set up civil patrols, including on Israeli beaches, to warn his Jewish women not to speak to Arab men and to police Arab men who have any intention of doing so. The National Civil Service Administration of Israel last fall issued a ban on religious Jewish women volunteering in hospitals after 9 p.m. for fear that they would date Arab doctors. And as an American Jew, I find this particularly peculiar because I've been raised to believe that it's good to date doctors. I produced a video called Feeling the Hate in Jerusalem during one of my first reporting trips to Israel. It's been banned by YouTube, banned by Vimeo. The Huffington Post refused to feature it. It was widely denounced because I simply showed young American Jews and Israelis kind of in a competition for who could make the most racist statement about Barack Obama and about African Americans, about Palestinians. It was a scene of just extreme, very organic, spontaneous racism in Zion Square, in the heart of Jerusalem, a place that many Jews consider the spiritual heart of the Jewish people. I personally, you know, consider Second Ave, where there's the delis and the Yiddish theaters, to be that, but that's just me. You know, I saw this video kind of as a warning. It was a warning of what was to come. This was at the dawn of the Netanyahu era. Of the Avigdor Lieberman era. And I wanted to warn people of the racism that was present and where it could lead. The warning was ignored, to my dismay, predictably, but I still found it tragic the way this video was treated and censored. And so in the summer of 2012, in the same exact location, in Zion Square in Jerusalem, a 19-year-old Palestinian named Jamal Julani was walking home from work on his way to East Jerusalem when he was set upon by a mob of Jewish youth, teenagers, no older than 16. 20 of them began beating him senseless, while hundreds stood by and watched and did nothing. Told by one of their female friends that Julani had made a pass at her. She later relented and admitted that her accusation was false. But one of the attackers, standing on the courthouse steps in Jerusalem, declared that his only regret was that he didn't kill Julani, who was in a coma at the time. And so we see that words have consequences, that settler colonialism has consequences, and that this is the natural course of Zionism as it seeks to consolidate the ethnically pure state that David Ben-Gurion and Theodore Herzl and the Founding Fathers sought to establish and failed to establish early on. Now, there is a new demographic threat facing Israel in its quest for ethnic purity, causing hysteria throughout the country. It's the 60,000 African asylum seekers who have fled Janjaweed in Sudan, who have fled repression in Eritrea and found a new kind of Janjaweed in Israel as they sought sanctuary in a place that they believed embraced and embodied the lessons of the Holocaust. Many of those Africans have been concentrated in South Tel Aviv and have faced race riots. They have faced massive incitement. On May 21st, 2012, Miri Regev, who is now the Interior Committee chairperson in the Knesset, stood before a crowd of 1,000 and declared that the Africans are a cancer in our national body. According to the Israeli Democracy Institute, 52% of Jewish Israelis agreed with that opinion, and a plurality supported violence against Africans, which was in the offing. That night, hundreds rampaged through African areas in South Tel Aviv, smashing windows and attacking any African they could find. It was a scene that was reminiscent of race riots we saw at the turn of the century in this country, early in the 20th century, in Tulsa, in Chicago, and elsewhere. somehow didn't make it into the New York Times until days later, and it was on page A15, an article by Isabel Kirshner about Israelis wringing their hands about the violence. No quotes from Africans. And so Netanyahu saw this as a call for action. The Knesset saw it as a call for action, and they amended legislation that had been originally passed to force Palestinians out, 1953 Prevention of Infiltration Act, which labeled all Palestinians who had left, been forced out of their homes in 47 and 48 and attempted to reunite with their families and their homes as infiltrators, rendering their presence illegal. This was now applied to Africans, allowing any non-Jewish African to be stopped, detained without charges, and indefinitely detained. And now there are currently hundreds, and there soon will be thousands, of Africans in the Holot detention or internment center in the Negev desert. The Israeli government calls this an open accommodation center. In, you know, terms that would, I think, impress Orwell. They do so because for those interned in this camp, you're allowed to leave, technically, if you just check in 3 times a day for roll call. But you have to be segregated from the Israeli public at night. At night, the camp closes, and you have to be there because of the fear that you will assimilate, the fear that you will meet Jewish Israelis, that you may form relationships with them, that you may have children of your own. Many of these Africans speak excellent Hebrew and are very productive members of Israeli society. Most of them speak better Hebrew than Alan Dershowitz and Abe Foxman. Unlike me, they cannot become citizens of the State of Israel. They cannot gain asylum because, unlike me, they don't have J-positive blood. And so there was a book by the historian James Lowen about towns that dotted the American landscape during the 1920s and 1930s. These towns enacted ordinances to prevent the presence of African Americans at night. And this includes Montgomery County, just outside Washington, D.C. And this has been abolished in this country, although it's still enforced through various means below the radar, like stop and frisk. But in Israel, it is part of the de jure system. And so with this anachronistic system, which segregates non-Jewish Africans from the Israeli public at night, Netanyahu and the Israeli government has made Israel the largest sundown town in the world. I wanted to read you a testimony from this camp, but I don't have time. I just want to make a point, which is that this camp has been referred to by former Knesset speaker Reuven Rivlin as a concentration camp. Rivlin from the Likud party, Rivlin the Sabra, whose family has lived in Israel for 8 generations. Not exactly an anti-Zionist militant, but someone who is disturbed by what was happening. And many Israelis are disturbed by what's happening and refuse to acknowledge that this is the natural outcome of an anachronistic system based on the philosophy of Zionism. But if you look in Israeli documents, this language is used as well. The document produced by Arnon Sofer, who is the key demographer in Israeli society. Sofer in Hebrew means counter, and they call him Arnon the Arab counter because he advises successive governments on how to control the demography to maintain a Jewish majority. In Sofer's document on the Holot detention camp, he called for rikuz. Rikuz means concentration, the concentration of the African population. And rikuz, that term, is also featured on the website of the Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial Foundation, which is Israel's main Holocaust museum, referring to the camps Jews were placed in during World War II. Of course, concentration camps are not unique to Jewish history. Zulus were kept in concentration camps. Native Americans are familiar with this system. Japanese Americans who are deemed to possess enemy race blood understand what concentration camps are. There are many living Japanese Americans who spent time in Manzanar in California. So this is not exclusive to Jewish history. However, there was someone who I write about in my book who saw this coming. And saw that Zionism and Israel would soon enter a terminal phase. His name was Yeshayahu Leibovich, and I want to tell you about him and close with some of his prophecies. Leibovich possessed 3 PhDs. He wrote the Encyclopedia Judaica, one of the finest minds the Zionist movement ever produced. He was a man who is said to know more about Maimonides than Maimonides himself. And none of the religious nationalist rabbis of Israel would dare face him in a debate. He was an anti-establishment figure, but not an anti-Zionist, at least in 1967, when Israeli society erupted in celebration when they entered the West Bank and conquered the Gaza Strip and the Golan Heights. And Leibovich stood completely against his entire society and warned that the Arabs would be the working people and the Jews the administrators, inspectors, officials, and police, mainly secret police, a state ruling a hostile population of 1.5 to 2 million foreigners would necessarily become a secret police state with all this implies for education, free speech, and democratic institutions. He said that Israel's problems, needs, and functions, this is in 1967, will no longer be those of the Jewish people in Israel abroad, but those arising from the specific tasks of government and administration of this strange system of political domination. And he warned that there would be a deep social strife, similar to one that existed in Rhodesia, Zimbabwe. He called Israel Rhodesia under a Jewish authority. 2 years later, Leibovich issued his most harrowing and horrible prophecy. He predicted that the occupation and this system that paralleled that in the time in Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, would enter into a malignant phase in which concentration camps would be erected by the Israeli rulers, and Israel would not deserve to exist, and it will not be worthwhile to preserve it. Leibovich was still beloved at the time because he advised Israelis. He was seen as a religious authority. They would come to him by the hundreds. They'd call him at night at his home and ask him questions on Jewish religious law. They would ask him how to quit smoking, basic questions. As his prophecies were slowly fulfilled, it was young people lining up at the office, at the door of Leibovich's office. Young people on their way to the killing fields of Beirut and South Lebanon. Young people on their way to enforce the occupation during the first intifada at age 17, and they asked Leibovich, what should we do? And he said, organize mass insubordination and refuse to participate in an army or face the consequence of becoming a Judeo-Nazi, someone who just follows orders. That was the term that he used. Leibovich was demonized for using this language and for calling for insubordination. Yet he was still nominated for the Israel Prize in 1991, Israel's top prize, its most prestigious award. Leibovich continued to call for a mass refusal until Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin demanded that the prize be rescinded. He withdrew the prize. He said he didn't want to create any more rancor. And a year later, he died in his sleep and would soon be sort of forgotten by Israel. Now we look at the situation. We look at the situation on the ground. We look at the situation I describe in this book, a situation many of you have witnessed on your trips to Israel-Palestine, a situation that Naeem witnesses every day in Jerusalem. And we realize that Leibovich's worst prophecies have been fulfilled, that they describe the reality on the ground, and yet his words still resonate with us. It is up to us, whose government is supporting the status quo and responsible largely for these facts on the ground and for protecting this anachronistic system. It's up to us to organize mass insubordination. It's up to us to refuse to comply, and it's up to us to change that reality on the ground. It's starting here. We'll change here, and we'll be back here to celebrate the new reality, inshallah.
That was author and journalist Max Blumenthal expanding on his latest book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. And that wraps up our broadcast for this week. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live at www.wzbc.org or listen to us at any time via the WZBC archive found on the homepage. Simply click on Archive, go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on this archive for 2 weeks. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.